Is Jeremy?
No, not yet.
Okay. Jeremy was asked, I think by one of the elders, what should Rick teach? And that resulted in a series of questions, which I have here in Jeremy's own handwriting, that I'd like to read to you as we begin our projected series of 8 sessions. It's under the topic, Understanding God. Is it possible to understand God? If not, why? If yes, how? How does God see his creation? What is his attitude toward us? How does God see me? Is he looking for things is he looking for good things we do, or is he looking for mistakes? Why does God allow suffering? Why was the death of Jesus the only way to cover sins? Why has Jesus not returned yet? What if I am angry or frustrated with God? What are the most important qualities of God that I need to understand? I am just one person. How am I to know God sees and cares for me? What does God want from me? To me, this is a very thought-provoking series of questions that is well thought out, and I appreciate very much that these have been passed on to me. The first question that we have here, is it possible to understand God, reminds me of the fact that there are probably 3 different categories of questions that we can ask or be asked. With some of those questions, we can give a full answer. There are some questions to which we can find in the Bible a concrete, explicit, definite, final answer. A question like, what must I do to be saved, for example? We don't have to wonder because the Bible tells us and tells us completely the answer to that question. 3 chapters of the Bible will take us a long way in answer to that. Acts 2, Acts 9, Acts 16. Men and brethren, what shall we do? Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? Sirs, what must I do to be saved? Those answers in those 3 chapters that are supplied to those questions are given by inspiration on all 3 occasions. So there are some kinds of questions that we can give full, complete answers to. There are other kinds of questions where we just have no information whatsoever. A question like, what was God doing before he created the universe? I have no information about that at all. There are a lot of questions like that that I can't even begin to answer. I don't even try to answer because it's impossible. It's evidently not information that I need at this point in my career to know. It's not essential for my spiritual well-being, and I don't have to have it answered right now. Maybe it'll be answered in the next phase of life. In fact, I think there's a lot of reason to believe that many of these questions unanswerable now will be answered later. I guess I could say maybe there's a 4th category as I think about it, because the Bible warns against attempting to answer some types of questions. 2 Timothy 2:23, foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing that they do gender strife. The attitude behind those kinds of questions could be the main issue there. Depending on whether a person is sincerely seeking information or whether they're trying to throw a monkey wrench into something. Like one time, I remember many years ago, somebody asked me, could God create a rock so big he couldn't move it? And they asked with a kind of a snide attitude, which indicated that they were trying to militate against the idea of there even being a God at all. And so they were asking questions to try to show how absurd the idea of God being all-powerful was. So these kind of things we're told to avoid unless they're asked with a good attitude. That would be a 3rd category, foolish and unlearned questions. But the 4th category, and the one I wanted to get to, of the questions that we might be asked, is questions that we can only partially answer, but not totally. Why did God create humanity is a question that would be in that category. We can answer it partially, but I can't give you a full answer to that, and I don't think anybody can. Some questions were forced to leave partially hanging. This one, why God created humanity in the first place, is in that category, and I think helps us to deal with the first question on Jeremy's list: is it possible to understand God? Why did God create us? What were his motives in doing this? Let's think about what his motives were not, first of all. God did not create us out of personal need, out of a lack that he found within himself. It can't be that God created man because he needed man or because he needed to make man. It was not because there was something lacking in God, because there's nothing lacking in God. Any other answer on that would militate against the infinity of God. God is infinite. In all of his attributes, in all of his qualities, he's infinite. He's infinitely holy. Isaiah 6:3, Revelation 4:8. Can God be any holier than he is? The answer is no. Could his holiness be enhanced or increased in any way? No. Could God be any wiser than he is? No, because he's already infinitely wise. He couldn't be any purer. He couldn't be any more righteous than he is. He couldn't be any more merciful than he is. He's infinite in all of these characteristics. He couldn't be any more powerful than he is. So he could not have created man to increase himself or to enhance himself in any way. He's already supreme and ultimate, already the all-being master of time, space, and dimension, and you just cannot go beyond that. God did not create us out of personal need. He did not create us to prove anything to anybody. Who would he have been trying to prove something to? Himself? Well, that would imply that he didn't already know. The angels? No, the angels came on the scene, I believe, within a week of the time that we ourselves were created. God didn't need to prove anything to the angels. The sons of God shouted for joy when the foundations of the earth were laid. Apparently, the angels were created on the first part of the first day of creation. So God didn't need to prove anything to himself, to the angels who are contemporaries with man, or to the Word of God, or to the Holy Spirit. So why then did he create us? Here's where I can give you a partial answer from the Bible. There are two verses that say most of what we're able to say about this. One is Revelation 4:11. Thou didst create all things for thy pleasure. They are and were created. Because of thy will, they were created. The creation of man was an exercise of God's sovereign will. Why did God create man? I really don't know, except that it was for his glory. That's the second passage to mention. Isaiah 43, verse 7, I have created man for my glory. Now, what does that mean? First, let's think about what it cannot mean. To have somebody to increase or enhance his glory is not what it means. The glory of God was already infinite. He could not have his glory increased in any way by the praise of man or the worship of man. There's no way we can increase the glory of God. Jesus made a very telling request in the real Lord's Prayer in John chapter 17, verse 5. Glorify thou me, speaking to his Father, with the glory which I had with you before the world began. Before the world was. That's very interesting to me because, of course, Jesus existed with God, the one we call Jesus now, the one who was called Jesus when he was born into this world. Prior to that, he was known as the living Word of God. He existed with God before the world was. And Jesus, at the point of his John 17 prayer, could remember being with God before the world was. We might wonder, when Jesus was growing up, at what point did that memory come into his mind? We're told that he grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. Jesus, as a human being, had a normally developing brain as he matured physically. All I know is that at some point, in that development, he began to remember being with God the Father before the foundation of the world. I don't think he remembered it when he was a baby in the manger. You couldn't have the experience of being a baby if you already had all these adult-type thoughts in your mind. But at some point in his development, he began to remember being with the Father before the foundation of the world. There's a lot more about that that I'd like to know than I'll ever be able to find out as long as I'm living on this earth. But he remembered that he had glory with the Father before the world was. And so now in John 17, he prays, "Glorify me with the glory I had with you before the world was." The glory that Jesus anticipated being glorified with was the same in measure and the same in degree of glory that the Father had before the world was. Think about what that means. That means that throughout all the several millennia of faithful, godly men and women, praising God, serving God, glorifying God, with all of that through all the years of human history, the glory of God had not been increased one iota. Even though lots of people were glorifying God continually, that did not increase the glory of God. Adam, Enoch, Moses, all the Hebrews 11 people did not increase the glory of God at all. We might think, I would have thought, that all those people glorifying God across the centuries would somehow increase God's glory. But if that were the case, then Jesus would have made more sense for him to say, glorify me with the glory that you now have. After all this glorifying, would have made more sense to pray for the present glory than for the past glory. So even though the Bible tells us that God created man for his glory, it was not because God needed the glory. It was because glorifying God was good for us. It was where our ultimate joy would be found. The deduction becomes obvious. God created man as an expression of his love. I think that's all it can be. God intrinsically is love. 1 John 4:8, God is love. Why does God want man to glorify him? Because man is in the image of God, and that's where man will find his purest joy. In serving God, we fulfill our very purpose for existing. Fear God and keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. If God does all things wisely and well, then we must assume it was better for God to have created man than not to have done so. Sometimes people think if they can't answer all the questions, then they're just not going to believe in God at all. But that doesn't make any sense. And we also need to assert that there are more questions in unbelief than there are in belief. Many more questions in unbelief than there are in belief. We're told in Romans chapter 11, verse 33, about God, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. His ways are inscrutable. We're told in Deuteronomy 29:29, that the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things which are revealed belong to us and his children. There are many more things that God has not revealed than there are things that he has revealed. Many more questions that can't be answered if you don't believe than if you do believe. If you don't believe, where did matter come from? How did matter spring into existence from non-matter? How did life come into existence from non-life? How did consciousness arise from non-consciousness? Where did intelligence come from? These are completely baffling if we don't have a first cause that was intelligent enough to have brought this all about and powerful enough to have done all of that. It's important to understand what God really wants us to understand and not to become overly preoccupied with questions which are just not answerable in this world. He wants us to ask, what must I do to be saved? How should I worship God? How should I live while I'm here? And he's given us full answers to these kinds of questions. But some things we cannot even presently fathom. Don't feel intimidated because you can't answer every question that somebody might ask you. Because the questions that are essential to people's spiritual well-being, God has especially equipped you to be able to answer. Now, to get a little more honed in on this first question on the sheet, is it possible to understand God? This is in the category of something I can partially answer, or I mean, we can partially understand God. God in His Word has given us true truth, but He has not given us exhaustive truth. There are many things He has not told us. He's told us the things that He deemed wise to tell us, the things that He believes we need to know. And that is all He's told us. There's nothing in the Bible that God does not think that we need to know. So is it possible to understand God? And the next part of Jeremy's question is, if not, why? That just brings to mind one simple quotation from the 55th chapter of the book of Isaiah. I'm sure some of you have already gone there with me in your mind. God says to His people in Isaiah 55 and 8, "My thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith Jehovah. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." That's why we cannot fully understand God. What God wants us to understand about Him, we're able to understand, and He's revealed that in the Bible. So that's the next part of the question. If not, why? Because God is up here and we're way down here. And if yes, how? Through what He's revealed in His Bible. This book is the only source of information from God. Anything else is either derivative of the Bible or is opposed to the Bible. So that's my answer to that first question. Is it possible to understand God? Yes, partially, and partially not. If not, why? Because God is so much greater than we are, and the things that we can understand, it's because we learn about them through the Bible. Anybody have any question, comment, or thought on that first question? Or on my attempt to answer it? Joseph. Oh, Mike.
I don't know if these are good questions or thoughts, but...
Probably are.
One of them, and it goes along with what you said, maybe not directly to the answer of the question, but... Does Ephesians 2 and 10 play into that, give us insight where it talks about, you know, for we are His workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works, that's part of the reason He created us?
Right. Absolutely so.
And then my other thought was, you mentioned, and I'm not trying to be a smart aleck or anything, but... I'm just trying to put my mind in somebody who's very skeptical, let's say.
Okay.
Sometimes. You mentioned that we were all created in love, and maybe this goes back to Isaiah where we don't fully comprehend, and if we try to comprehend something above it, we fail at that miserably. But a thought occurred to me that somebody might, if that's the case, right, in this human world, if I created something I love, it would be hard for me to set up a situation where I would have to destroy it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I think it was Jesus that said in Matthew about Judas, it would be better if that man had not been born.
Right.
Better for that man if he had not been born.
Right.
So, I don't know. Those are just hard things for my mind to wrap around, and I think for a lot of people probably.
Yeah. I appreciate that question very much, and I think that we can go some way toward dealing with that, but maybe not deal with it fully, because we don't understand God. I've often had people, when the topic of discussion is hell, and people will say, well, as poor of a loving person as I am, I wouldn't send my children to hell. How could God send His children to hell, or His creation to hell? And that's often said by Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, who don't believe in hell the way the Bible describes it, but just talk about annihilation and going out of existence. sometimes in response to that, I say, well, I wouldn't put my children out of existence either. So where does that leave us? I don't know that we know everything that goes on when those decisions are being made. It takes confidence, faith, trust in God to come to satisfaction about this. Like Abraham asked in very ancient times, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? And he had confidence that God would do the right thing, whether he understood it or not. And sometimes I'm just left with that. It's the best I can do. Because God takes into account, the mind of God is sufficiently magnificent and universal to take into account every factor. I only know a few of the factors, and my knowledge of them may be imperfect or misled. But God perfectly knows all of the factors, all of the opportunities that people had, all the decisions they made within their minds. He makes the final decision, and that's why I'm supposed to stay off the judgment seat and on the love seat. And it's an excellent question. Every time a variety of that question is asked, I think it's so much better a question than my answer. But that's about the best I can do. Who can help us in answering Joseph's question? Bill.
The thought that went through my mind while you were speaking, along with what Joseph had asked, is when God said, let us make up, man in our image. Well, that presents a choice, what man's going to do. Right. And in 1 Corinthians, the 6th chapter, when it talks about, we made the choice of being the temple of God. And therefore, for ye are bought with a price, therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. So how do we respond? How we respond to God determines on whether or not we bring him glory. Wouldn't that be correct?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Well, on that issue of hell, I mean, I don't have any more answer than you do, but one of the things that helps me, because as you know, we've discussed this. I mean, I've grappled with that. You know, how do you make any sense of this? Because this is a powerful argument on the face of it from the atheist. Right. But the cross has to be part of the discussion.
That's right.
Because the God who made us knowing that part of him, if we want to put it that way, was going to come to earth. Jesus, as he was making us, knew that he was going to be coming to the earth, limiting himself for that period of time, and then willingly allow us to torture him and kill him, and then what he was experiencing those 3 hours of darkness, I know not. That is not the behavior of a being who does not love me.
Right.
So I can't answer all the questions on the one, but I have this undeniable evidence of his love on the other side of it.
Right. Well said. Thank you. Peter.
I don't know how helpful of an argument this is, but just from a philosophical point of view, if we're going to talk about how God is completely loving, then we also need to talk about how God is completely just. And in that sense, heaven is just as unjust as hell is unloving. So if you're not content with hell, then why are you okay with heaven?
Yeah.
You know, they have to both be considered.
That's true. And often in our discussions with friends and neighbors, I find people who believe in heaven but not in hell. There's an imbalance there. And the reason, of course, is because as a race of people, we tend to believe what we want to believe. What else we got, Boone? Is that it? Okay, very good discussion. I appreciate that. And from the tone of your comments and questions, I can see that I think we're on the same page in dealing with a question like, is it possible to understand God? You can always go back to that and say more about it if you want to. The second question is, how does God see his creation? What is his attitude toward us? How does God see me? And that's not only very interesting, but also, I think, a very important question. I think our answer to this question has been tempered over time. People a couple of generations ago tended to answer it one way. I now, in the 21st century, would tend to answer it another way. Not because we have new information, but just because things change around us and affect our ways of thinking. So I think it's important, a very important question to consider, and I know that Jeremy thinks it is because I happened to be at your Memorial Day meeting a few years ago when you were out in Pleasant Hill, Missouri. Remember that? I don't know what year that was, but it was because of the COVID scare, and you rented a building out there in Pleasant Hill. Jeremy spoke and spoke to this subject during a part of his talk. I remember it because he mentioned something that he had heard me say down at Eminence. You remember that, Jeremy? And I thought he might have been thinking of that when he wrote this question. He cited something that I had said in the Summersville Community Center down in southern Missouri. It was on a Wednesday night a few years ago, probably about 10 years ago. I guess we were in Summersville because it must have been raining at the campground. But my assignment then was about the heart of God and also about David being a man after God's own heart. David is the only person in the Bible that is said to be a man after God's own heart, explicitly by name, which is very interesting because when we think of the life of David, it was less than exemplary in many ways. And if we emphasize that part of David, we might not even like him very much when we got through talking about his life. But yet God said he's a man after my own heart. So what's up with that? I think answering that question helps us to answer how God sees us as his creation, because it has to do with David's heart being like or in similitude toward the heart of God. How does God see his creation? What is his attitude toward us? And specifically, how does God see me? I'd like to, with your kind indulgence, take a little time to answer this question, because since Jeremy asked it and Jeremy made that comment a few years ago in Pleasant Hill, Missouri, I think he kind of wanted me to maybe talk about that a little bit more. So I will introduce David, Lord willing, with the rest of the time we have tonight, and then just take this up next week, because I think this is critically important. The only one in all of Scripture to be called a man after God's own heart. And by the way, he's mentioned more than any other Old Testament character in the pages of the New Testament. We have 59 references to David in the New Testament, as well as approximately 66 chapters about David in the Old Testament. There's nobody else that's covered in that manner in the Old Testament. Abraham's story is told in 14 chapters. Joseph's story is told in 14 chapters. Jacob's story is told in 11 chapters. Elijah's story is told in 10 chapters. But with David, we have 66 chapters, not even mentioning the 59 references to him in the New Testament. From all antiquity, the story of David is probably the greatest single narrative representation of a human life evolving by slow steps over time. When we first meet him, we find that he was ruddy, with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance. That's the only physical description we have of young David. He may have had red hair, or maybe more likely, he was just reddened or bronzed from the hours he spent out in the sun and wind. His appearance did not seem to set him apart from other people. He was the youngest in his family. When Samuel came to his house to anoint the next king, David's father didn't even think of having David in the room on that important occasion until Samuel finally asked, "Are these all your sons here?" "Well, there's my youngest, but he's out in the field tending the sheep." David was born about 10 years after Saul became king. The people of Israel were in a long drift away from God. They were becoming disillusioned with the king that they had wanted so badly. It must have been embarrassing. Have you ever gotten what you wanted? You got your own way, and then it's going all wrong? It's disillusioning. There's an insecure feeling there. But God didn't abandon his people. Samuel said to Saul, "You have behaved foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now, Saul, your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord has appointed him as ruler over his people, because you, Saul, have not kept what the Lord commanded you." 1 Samuel 13, verses 13 and 14. I guess the thing that interests me about David's life story as narrated in the Old Testament is his evolution over time. That's just fascinating. I like to see that in any biography. He was shaped, he was altered by the pressures of political life, public institutions, pressures of family, pressures from the impulses of his body and the impulses of his mind, and eventually the sad decay of his own flesh. The story of David provides an unflinching insight into human behavior. Nowhere else is the Bible's ability to define its characters more brilliantly deployed than in the story of David. And on two occasions, he's called a man after God's own heart, meaning that God saw something in David that he could use, but it was not on the surface. Man looked on the outward appearance, but God looked on the heart. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1:26, "You see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of this world to confound the wise, and the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. The base things of the world and things despised God hath chosen, and the things that are not, that he might nullify the things that are, that no man should boast before God." God looked at David and saw spirituality in him. People are terribly enamored of the surface of things. People get elected to high political office just on the basis of appearance. David didn't look much different from any other boy, I don't think. If we had been his neighbors, we might not have even known David's name. He had all those older brothers. So what does it mean that you're a person after God's heart? It means that what is important to God is important to you. It means you have a heart that is sensitive to the things of God. 2 Chronicles 16:9. "The eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong in behalf of them whose heart is perfect toward him." In every generation, there are always some people whose heart is perfect or mature toward God. To be after God's heart means that when you do wrong, you admit it and you come to terms with it. It means that you're grieved over wrong. You're concerned about things that displease God. You care about the motivations behind your actions. So David had a spirituality that was somewhat uncommon. Also, a second quality God saw in David was his humility. He was out there faithfully keeping his father's sheep. God saw the heart of a servant in David. God didn't care about head and shoulders taller. I don't know how many times I've stood right here and led a big class of kids in that song, Head and Shoulders Taller. It's about King Saul, Head and Shoulders Taller. If Lois was here, she'd start singing it with me. Good song about how Saul appealed to people just by his personal appearance, but he was a weak man and a terrible king. So God saw into the heart of David. He saw, is this man authentic or is he a fake? God cared about character, not about head and shoulders. The purpose of a servant is to make somebody else successful. A servant does not want the person he serves to fail. God looked at David. He saw spirituality. He saw humility. He saw integrity. As it was said in the Psalms, Psalm 78, verses 71 and 72. "From the care of the ewes with suckling lambs, he brought him to shepherd Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with his skillful hands." Integrity is what you are when nobody's looking. The training ground of David was lonely, obscure, monotonous, and it was real. God trained David in solitude. Nature was his nurse, his companion, his teacher. Bethlehem is 5 or 6 miles south of Jerusalem. I've stood in Bethlehem and I could see the city of Jerusalem just a few miles up to the north. Bethlehem is 2,000 feet above the level of the Mediterranean. It's got rich fields where Ruth once gleaned, and which gave the place its name, Bethlehem, House of Bread. The moorlands around Bethlehem are wild, gaunt, strong, and character breeding. This is the place where David first imbibed that knowledge of natural scenery and pastoral pursuits, which colored all of his life and all of his poetry. Solitude has nurturing qualities. People who have to have lots of superficial sounds tend to lack depth. If you can't stand to be alone with yourself, there's something unresolved within you. Solitude has a way of helping us address those kinds of issues. When was the last time you got all alone with nature and just soaked it in, so far alone, so far out that the sound of silence seemed almost deafening? I've had that experience a few times in recent years, but many times when I was a boy. But that's where David lived. That's where David first learned to be king. Surely for many, many nights he sat alone under the stars and felt the winds of autumn and the rains of winter and endured the summer sun. Solitude was one of David's teachers. When I was a boy, you could get out into the woods like that a lot easier than we seem to be able to now. Today, if a young person goes into the woods and they've got their phone with them, then in prospect, all their friends are right there with them. It's just a completely different experience. But David didn't have a phone. He grew up in obscurity, unknown, unseen, unappreciated, unapplauded. Character is built in obscurity. David was trained in monotony. He had a menial routine day after day through endless hours. It was real training. In 1 Samuel 17, David is standing by Saul when the giant appears. Saul was scared to death, went to hiding in his tent. And David said, "Who is this Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And Saul says, "Well, who are you? You're just a kid." But David said, "I've been with my father's sheep." Saul says, "You can't fight the Philistines." And David says, "Without hesitation, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock. I went out after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him." Verses 34 and 35 of 1 Samuel 17. David had been killing lions and bears while nobody was around. He'd been facing that kind of reality long before he ever faced Goliath. It's in the little things, it's in the lonely places that we prove ourselves capable of bigger things. We each need to cultivate the habit of doing little things well. The conversion of a soul can happen in a moment, but the development of a saint is the task of a lifetime. You don't have to be smart to be obedient. All you have to do is obey. For David, the day that Samuel came to his house started with a morning like any other day. Samuel looked at Eliab, David's oldest brother, and said, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him. Surely this is the one. Good looking kid." What Samuel didn't see was the character of Eliab. As we get to know Eliab better throughout the narrative, we find that Eliab was critical, he was negative, and he looked down on his younger brother. The parade of possibles went by in Jesse's living room, and the Lord literally told Samuel, "Man looks at the face, God looks at the heart." Wouldn't that be something if when we looked at people, we didn't see their physical form and face, but we saw their heart, what it's really like? Wouldn't that be a shocker? Not many of us would want to be seen that way. But God saw Eliab and Abinadab and Shammah as they really were. and he did not select them to be the next king. David, as a teenager, walks into the house, and an old man comes over and pours oil on his head, and Josephus says that Samuel whispered in David's ear, "You will be the next king." What did David do? Did he go shopping for crowns? Go down to Crown Center for a crown? No. He went right back to the sheep. We'll take that up there next time. I don't want to go too far over. Yeah, go ahead, Mark. Here comes the mic.
So the passage you'd use in 1 Samuel 16, where he said God looks upon their heart, he already had a heart that God desired. And so in verse 13 of that same chapter, 16, where it says, "And the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward," was the Spirit of the Lord what gave the confidence that David had, or was it just enhancing what he already had?
I think it enhanced what he already had. David was already a certain kind of individual, and the Spirit of God helped to bring that out. Any other thoughts, questions, or comments on what Mark asked? Yeah, Brenda?
Do you think someone is born with that instinct, or do you think it's something that they learn?
Well, I do think that anybody can be a person after God's heart if they choose to. I hope I wasn't misleading. I said that David is the only one specifically mentioned by name as a man after God's own heart, and that's true. But there were other people who were after God's heart as well. We're just not told who they were. For instance, in the book of Jeremiah, chapter 3, "I will give you shepherds," or pastors. Those words are interchangeable. Jeremiah usually says pastors, and Ezekiel says shepherds, but it's the same group of people. "I will give you shepherds," or pastors, "after my own heart."
The way David's heart was, he was very compassionate. He was very good. What I'm talking about, is that something you think he learned by taking care of those sheep, or do you think
it was something that he it was kind of in his personality traits? You see what I'm saying?
I think he learned some of it, but I think part of it was already there from the beginning. Just like with my favorite president, Abraham Lincoln. He's reared in poverty, and he had less opportunities than most people, no more opportunities than anybody. Everybody where he lived had a cabin and a hearth and a fireplace and a shovel. But Lincoln was the one who was up at night by the firelight with a piece of charcoal doing his math problems on the back of that shovel, because he was Abraham Lincoln. He had that thing in him. Not everybody had that. But we can all develop from where we are. I think David developed from where he was. You're asking good things. I appreciate it very much, but I've already gone almost 5 minutes over the time. We'll, Lord willing, try to recapture this next week and talk a little more about this and get to my eventual answer to Jeremy's very good question: how does God view us, his creation? Right now, we conclude with the gospel invitation. If there's someone outside of Christ tonight who would come to him in simple trusting faith, or if you have anything else to bring before the assembled brethren, let us know how we can assist you by coming to the front as we stand together and sing the number Jeremy will lead.
612 in the red. Verses 1, 3, and 4.